Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. I know you are all fans of true crime, which can only mean you also love mystery in all its forms. That's why I am so excited to share with you my new show, Rabia Chaudhry Presents the Mystery Hour with the Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queen Mystery Magazines. In this show, every single week, I narrate the best mystery writing in North America from two legendary mystery and thriller publications, the Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queen Mystery Magazines. Now, I know you will love the stories, and more so, you are going to love the afterwords at the end of every story where I share real-life true crime stories that mirror the fictional one you just heard. So check out the premiere episode of The Mystery Hour, a story called A Small Mercy. And then don't forget to find the show on your favorite podcast app and subscribe today. See if you can solve the mystery before the story ends, and enjoy. Hi, and welcome to Rabia Chaudhry Presents The Mystery Hour with the Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queen Mystery Magazines. Our very first story comes to us from the November-December 2023 edition of the Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. Enjoy A Small Mercy by Alice Hatcher. I can admit without shame that I was afraid when I found the sliding glass door between the dining room and patio standing wide open. If not for the screeching wind and the palm fronds scraping the eaves, the police sirens growing louder, and the concussive sounds of two helicopters sweeping searchlights across the foothills edging Monte Vista Estates, I would have said the house was silent. Absent the usual dinnertime sounds of TVs blaring, pots banging, and children racing down hallways, the house seemed eerily deserted. At the same time, a solitary light burning upstairs suggested the presence of another person, someone maintaining an unnerving silence and unwilling to announce themselves. So yes, I was afraid. Fear is a part of being alive. When my heart started racing and my skin grew flush, I was having a normal physiological response to an imminent threat. The only unusual thing, I suppose, is that I decided to search the house, throwing caution to the wind and risking an unnecessary confrontation with a stranger. With a manhunt obviously underway, most people would have backed out of the house and let anyone inside leave unchallenged. I'm not like most people, though. My old therapist once said that, as the child of an alcoholic and erratically violent father, I developed certain maladaptive tendencies. I learned to confuse normalcy with stagnation and seek out dangerous situations just to feel alive. It's true. I feel most alive in moments of crisis, and my risk-taking behavior has left some of my most important relationships in tatters. In fairness to myself, there was something exceptional about that night, an odd confluence of factors muting my apprehension, my appreciation of danger. I'd had a terrible time at work, battling one mishap after the other, and left with a throbbing headache that only worsened as the barometric pressure plunged, presaging the kind of monsoon storm that can erupt without warning in southern Arizona. The headache alone might have driven anyone to distraction. If I'm to be honest, my response to finding the door open extended well beyond fear and shaded into something close to rage. I experienced a primal, almost predatorial impulse to track down anyone hiding inside the house. To the rising wail of police sirens, I slipped into the kitchen, set my briefcase on the counter, and by the light of the oven's digital display, drew a chef's knife from the butcher block beside the sink. There was no turning back and surrendering the house once my fingers curled around the hilt. I surveyed the open expanse of the dining and living room and listened for sounds of movement, much the way a fox or coyote would sniff the ground to detect the presence of a vole or mouse tunneling through a field, but I couldn't identify any sign of disturbance. Every drawer was on its runners, every chair in its place, and every shelf arrayed as I had expected, with vases and books and electronic gadgets. I considered the possibility that someone had heard my approach and fled the house, but the front door and the door to the garage were locked from the inside. After a quick check of the pantry and closets, I concluded that either someone had accidentally left the patio door open, or that a stranger was lying in wait upstairs. Terrified and desperate enough to employ violence, or if I was lucky, as yet unaware of my presence. I stood at the base of the stairway for a long moment, weighing my options, and then took the first two steps at once, grateful for the thick carpeting on the treads. Halfway up the stairs, I paused to catch my breath and felt the full force of my headache, pounding in strange synchronicity with the sounds of helicopters' rotor blades. When I started to question my judgment, I told myself that anyone armed with a gun and aware of my presence would have already confronted me. Resolved, I rounded the corner at the top of the stairs and started toward the light burning in the bedroom at the end of the hallway. I didn't waste much time the first three rooms flanking the hallway. The sparsely furnished guest room with its unmade bed and shallow closet filled with file boxes, the half-bathroom with a pedestal sink, or the carpeted study, where I did little more than circle the sprawling Chippendale desk and peer behind the wingback chair. At the end of the hallway, I entered the master bedroom and stepped into the pale green light of the Tiffany lamp on the nightstand. I glanced behind the dresser and tested the lock on the French doors leading to the balcony. I checked the master bathroom to make sure no one was hiding in the double shower. In the walk-in closet, I ran my hand down the far side of built-in shoe caddies and peered into the spaces behind suits and dresses hanging in plastic body bags. Finally, I turned my attention to the room across the hall, the last place anyone might be hiding. When I flipped the light switch, the walls came alive with the soft glow of a familiar pink. I considered the t-shirts, gym shoes, and gel pens scattered across the floor, the strings of beads dangling from a mirror's frame, and the cheap jewelry, plastic barrettes, and bottles of nail polish cluttering the dresser. Maybe a sudden ebb of adrenaline had left me unbalanced, or the imagined threat retreating from my mind had made way for other things. But when I saw the rounded wooden letters spelling Chloe mounted on the wall, I sat down on the bed, exhausted. I stared intently at the letters' painted edges, ruminating on the alienation, the sense of suffocation I'd always felt in the face of domestic routines, and how my inability to accept the constraints of ordinary life had impacted a girl too young, and probably too sheltered, to understand the ferment in a soul like mine. I whispered the name Chloe twice and almost cried. Overcome with regret and self-loathing, I considered the stuffed animals and ruffled pillows piled against the headboard and the purple marker lying in a fold of the comforter. I could only wonder how I'd gotten to the point of sitting on a young girl's bed, Chloe's bed, with a chef's knife in my hand and so many demons crowding my mind. I drew my hand away from a stuffed cat with plastic green eyes and looked at my mirror reflection, knowing I could never atone for all the pain my impulsive behavior had caused Chloe. Sickened, I rose from the bed and approached the dresser to study a school photo wedged into the mirror's frame. I was probably torturing myself, but I set the knife beside a silver charm bracelet and took the photo in my hand. I studied the saddle of freckles across Chloe's nose, the strands of blonde hair loosened from the braid resting on her shoulder, and the gap between her front teeth. "She's a stranger to me," I whispered, shaking my head. "I don't even know her." I held the photo close to my face to better see her pale blue eyes. She looked so downcast and anxious, just like I'd been at her age, caught in the turbulent transition from childhood to adolescence. I imagined her morphing from a nervous young girl into an inscrutable teenager, and then an emotionally adrift woman prone to depression. Thinking of the shadows I had cast across her path, I experienced the additional guilt of trespassing in her room, a place that would likely become her only refuge as the undertow of adolescence drew her deep into her own world, away from the endless dysfunction and malign influences of inconstant adults. I considered the web of scar tissue covering the side of my hand and wedged the photo back into the mirror's frame, shaken by the thought that I had just become like my own father. I had done the unforgivable. I had ruined a young life before it truly began. I was staring at a tiny dolphin affixed to Chloe's charm bracelet when the sound of the backyard gate banging in the wind startled me. My scalp tingled and my breath grew shallow as I realized that both the sliding glass door to the patio and the outer gate were wide open. I turned off the light, edged up to Chloe's window, and tried to see something through the fog of condensed breath clinging to the glass. For several minutes, I massaged my temple and stared down at the patio, surveyed the top of the adobe wall edging the yard, and looked out across the golf course, trying to discern any hint of a human form in the darkness. I could barely think. Between my headache and the sounds of sirens, the neighbors' dogs setting each other off like so many malfunctioning car alarms, the erratic clang of someone's wind chimes, and palm fronds scraping the side of the house. Only when a helicopter swept its beam over a nearby street did I draw away from the window and race down the stairs, driven by a renewed sense of urgency. The first drops of rain started to fall as I stepped out into the patio. I scanned the garden beds and dark spaces between potted cacti and made my way to the gate, straining against its hinges. I wrestled the gate closed and lowered its wooden hatch, and when I turned back to the house, I noticed that I had left the hot tub uncovered. I cursed my own carelessness, and wondering whether the windborne dust and debris had already damaged the tub's filtration system, I drew the insulated cover over the murky water. I gathered a padlock from the ground, slid the shackle through a hasp on the cover, and slipped its small key into my pants pocket as a police car passed in front of the house. Arrested by the sight of red and blue lights streaking between the branches of a mesquite, I stood perfectly still, listening to a loudspeaker announcement instructing everyone in the vicinity to stay inside while the police searched for a suspect assumed to be armed and dangerous. With an unnerving sense that I was being watched, I retreated into the house and locked the patio door, seconds before the first cloudburst covered the glass in a wash of rain. I tested the locks on every door, assuring myself that I would hear something, that I would have some kind of warning if anyone tried to force their way into the house. I felt for the dimming switch on the wall behind my briefcase and illuminated the first floor just enough to see my way around without obliterating my view of the backyard with stark reflections of the dining room and kitchen. In the spare light, I saw a handwritten note lying on the counter, beside the car keys and leather wallet, the phone unplugged beneath its charger, and the wicker basket overflowing with unpaid bills. Before I could read it, the phone lit up with a succession of text messages. With my headache spiking, I struggled to read the texts. Everyone in the neighborhood association, it seemed, was sharing observations and speculations about the circling helicopters, the police cars converging on Kai Jardin, the ambulances parked in front of the Shelton's house, and the barricades and stretches of yellow crime scene tape appearing at the edges of the Shelton's property. I knew the Shelton house, the biggest in the development, a palazzo with miniature balconies and wrought iron gates, a tiered marble fountain, and a circular drive lined with towering cypress trees. I'd found the Sheltons ostentatious, everything from their matching Cadillacs to their marble statuary, intolerable. But I felt sick reading about the ambulances. I set down the phone and rubbed the crease between my eyebrows. When I regained focus, I turned my attention to the note. It was written in tight, perfectly aligned rows on a piece of white printer paper. "Ted, I assume you're at happy hour again and didn't remember Chloe's school play," I read aloud with a growing tightness in my chest. "The play means a lot to her, and I was hoping you'd show up, but then you haven't been showing up for much in a long time, between your drinking and your moods. I'm taking Chloe and Jade out for pizza after the play, presumably without you. We'll be home about 9:30 or 10. The floor seemed to list as if the house were a foundering ship and my precarious equilibrium started to slip. I leaned against the counter for balance and continued reading. "It would be better to show up late than not at all, but please stay home if you're just going to stagger in and cause a scene. The spotlight should be on Chloe for once. The play starts at 7. Diane." I repeated Diane's name 3 times and folded the note into my pocket, and something inside of me loosened like a snake uncoiling. Whatever could be said about Diane, she was right about one thing. Chloe didn't need any more upheaval on my account. She didn't deserve to witness the inevitable confrontation that would happen if Diane came home to face me in her perfect kitchen with its unused copper pots, polished stainless steel appliances, and pristine espresso machine. The only thing left to do was get out of the house before things got even uglier. The alternative was to sit helplessly, watching the clock and waiting, counting down minutes and dreading the moment the hour hand reached 10. I imagined Chloe in her costume without even knowing her role, or for that matter, the name of the play. For some reason, I imagined her as a princess in a pink taffeta gown and a plastic tiara, nervously rehearsing her opening lines behind the folds of a tawdry red curtain and hoping to see her father seated in the front row. "I'm poison to her," I muttered, noticing a wine stain on the front of my shirt. I'd messed up in too many ways already, and my only option was to pack a few things and leave, for at least a few days, especially while Diane railed about alcoholic blackouts and selfish disappearing acts. Chloe would assume her father was a drunken deadbeat who had failed in his family responsibilities, and she would be right. But the time for indecision had passed. I should have cleared out of the house right then, but I couldn't go anywhere with the neighborhood in lockdown, and I admit I was ravenous. I opened the refrigerator and ate 4 stuffed pasta shells straight from a tray with my bare hands, like an animal, I imagined Diane saying. When I'd eaten my fill, I wiped my fingers on my pants and glanced at the oven display. It was only 7:25, so I decided to clean up and change my clothes. I reeked of sweat and spent adrenaline, and if I was going to leave, whether quietly or with some final outburst, I could at least leave with a shred of dignity. Upstairs, I turned on the lights in the master bathroom and leaned into the mirror spanning the double sinks. I nearly recoiled. My face was drawn, almost gaunt, beneath a shock of salt and pepper hair, covered with stubble, and deeply creased with the corners of my heavily lidded eyes turned downward. I rubbed my eyes with my thumb and middle finger, planted my palm on the cool marble counter, and examined a small fishbowl containing polished seashells on a bed of white sand, a hairbrush with an engraved silver handle, and a crystal perfume bottle with an antique pump and faded cursive label. "I don't belong here," I muttered, overcome by a familiar sense of displacement, and turned away from my reflection. I might have showered, but I didn't have much time, so I just stripped off my shirt and pants, splashed cold water on my face and neck, and patted myself dry with a fresh hand towel. I dragged a stick of deodorant across my armpits, freshened my mouth with fluoride rinse, and flossed my teeth. Then I washed every fleck of food into the drain and wiped down the sink with a towel. I could do that much for Diane, I decided, looking at the anti-aging creams and hand moisturizers neatly arrayed on the counter, the meticulously polished faucets, and the eucalyptus oil diffuser plugged into the wall. After folding the towel, I rifled the drawers of the vanity until I found a bottle of Advil buried beneath a variety of scented soaps from upscale hotels. It was 8:12 when I popped 4 pills and started packing. I didn't take much. I wasn't in any state of mind to dwell on the cuts of shirts and colors of ties. I didn't even bother with a suitcase. I just grabbed a Gucci day bag from the closet and loaded it with 3 pairs of socks and boxer briefs, a polo shirt pulled from the dresser, and a Madras shirt and 2 beige khakis pulled from the closet. I dressed quickly, in fresh black slacks and a blue Oxford yanked off 2 wooden hangers, a little concerned that the nicest leather wingtips in the closet hadn't been broken in to accommodate my toes. After sweeping the deodorant, a toothbrush and comb, some aftershave, and an electric razor into the bag, I dropped my stained shirt and pants into the hamper, reassuring myself that, by leaving, I was making the best bad decision I could for Chloe. Before going downstairs, I visited Chloe's room one last time. I stared at her class photo for a long moment, and then, without much thought, prized open a wire loop connecting a tiny silver turtle to a link in her charm bracelet. Thinking it might act as a talisman of sorts, or as a reminder of Chloe that would give me the strength I needed to change, I slipped the charm into my pocket. As I did so, I noticed a bead of blood on my index finger, where the tip of the wire had punctured my skin. There was a trace of blood on the bracelet, too, and for reasons I don't entirely understand, I didn't wipe it off. I left Chloe's room feeling more gutted than I ever thought possible. Downstairs, I grabbed my briefcase and, with Diane's bag slung over my shoulder, prepared to load the car so I'd be ready to leave as soon as the lockdown ended. When I unlocked the laundry room door and reached into the garage for a wall switch, I had a flash of irrational fear that hardly abated when watery yellow light fell upon the tinted windshield of the black Lexus. I knew almost without a doubt that no one was in the garage, but I felt unnerved standing on carefully swept concrete, listening to the amplified drumbeat of sideways rain battering the garage door and staring at the carelessly parked car angled diagonally across two concrete slabs. Before memories of my father staggering home every night overcame me, I popped open the trunk and deposited my briefcase and Diane's day bag next to an empty cardboard box section to hold wine bottles. Thinking I never wanted to touch a glass of wine again, I slammed the trunk shut and went back inside. I paced back and forth in the kitchen, rubbing my forehead and listening to loudspeakers, watching red and blue lights play upon the living room drapes, and reading text alerts sent to the neighborhood listserv. Barbara, 1962, claimed to have seen a body being wheeled out of the Shelton house on a stretcher. M.T. Zoll insisted the paramedics hadn't entered the house yet. Jake, Monte Vista's security guard, reported that the police had taken command of the booth at the main gate. Dozens of others wondered how long the lockdown would last. No one knew much of anything except that the Shelton property was crawling with cops in yellow rain slickers. All I knew was that I needed to get out of the house. There's an emotional breaking point when patience becomes impossible, and I couldn't sit around waiting, growing more agitated by the minute with barking dogs and incessant sirens, dreading the moment Diane walked in the door with poor Chloe in tow. I reached that point at 8:32, when I decided to call the police and report a possible break-in. I knew I'd seem ridiculous to any seasoned cop pulled away from a manhunt, but I was willing to risk humiliation if it meant that Chloe would return to an unquestionably safe house. As I saw it, my only chance to spare Chloe from another emotional blow was to petition the police for an exemption to the lockdown as a harried father trying to do the right thing for his daughter. My headache was raging, and I was grateful that the emergency function on the phone allowed me to connect to 911 without a hassle. "My name's Ted McLean. I live at 953 Manzanita Drive in Monte Vista Estates." I leafed through the contents of the basket beside the phone charger as I answered the dispatcher's questions, shaking my head at all the credit lines Diane had established at every kind of store, the staggering balances on the monthly statements from Visa and Fidelity Mortgage, the 3-page receipt and detailed summary of services from Merry Maids, and an invitation to a Hawaiian-themed happy hour in Monte Vista's clubhouse. "I've done a preliminary search of the house," I said after recounting my discovery of the unlatched gate and open door. "I didn't find anything missing, but I thought I should report anything suspicious, given what's going on in the neighborhood." After putting me on hold for 30 seconds, the dispatcher told me that two officers in the vicinity would be at my house within 5 minutes. I placed a credit card statement back in the basket and looked around to see if I had missed anything essential. As I padded my pants pocket for my wallet, my eyes homed in on a framed family portrait hanging in the living room. I turned on the lamp beside the couch and approached the photograph. As in her class photo, Chloe looked anxious. I imagined her on stage, stumbling through her last lines and scanning the audience, an apprehensive princess brimming with disappointment and sadness. And there was Diane, carefully posed and painted with mascara, baring her teeth in a brittle smile. She was good-looking without being beautiful, I thought, and then berated myself for placing unreasonable expectations on her, much as my father had made impossible demands on my mother. Diane had probably been straining to keep up appearances for years. I tried to convince myself I was doing her a favor by yanking the band-aid. She would suffer the sting of unexpected loneliness, but she'd escape the protracted pain of escalating conflict. I lifted the portrait from the wall, and, thinking that Chloe's image, like the charm from her bracelet, might motivate me to become a better man, I returned to the garage and placed the framed photo face down in the trunk. The family portrait was the last thing I took from the house. It was the last thing I took from Diane and Chloe. Two officers arrived at 8:38. They parked on the driveway and walked briskly to the front stoop to escape the steady downpour. I had turned on the porch light and several lights in the house, and I was waiting for them at the door. "I'm Ted McLean, the one who called." I stepped aside to let them enter. "I'm sorry to take up your time on such a busy night." "This is our job," said the older officer, an overweight guy with a sagging chin covered in razor burn. "I'm Officer Connell. This is Officer Patel," he added, gesturing to his young partner, an otherwise lean guy with a soft face. Is anyone else in the house?" Officer Patel asked, resting his hand on his hip, just beside his gun's grip. "It's just me. My wife and daughter were both out when I got home from work." Maybe I overreacted when I called you, but they'll be home soon. I thought it would be better to be safe than sorry. Officer Patel approached the glass door. This the one you found open? Yeah, that's it. I considered the sheets of rain unfolding across the patio and the runoff from the garden shed roof splattering on the hot tub cover. I did a fairly thorough search inside, and I didn't find any signs of disturbance or anything missing. You didn't find any signs of forced entry? Nothing. Do you keep firearms in the house? None. Chloe, our 13-year-old, gets into everything. Officer Connell surveyed the foyer floor. So you didn't do a walk around outside? I went out into the patio, and then I heard the loudspeakers and came back inside. I've never heard that kind of announcement in this neighborhood. With it pissing buckets like this, I'm not sure what we'd see if we went outside, but the dispatcher's sending a chopper over right now. Everyone around here's been texting, I ventured. I don't know what you're allowed to talk about, but someone mentioned an ambulance at the Sheltons. Is everything okay? All I can say is we're searching for a suspect who might be hiding in this development. Officer Connell paused during a burst of static from the radio secured to his shoulder. We're asking for everyone's patience while we secure the area. Any other time I might not have called, but tonight... You did the right thing, Officer Connell said, approaching the staircase. Would you mind if I took a look around upstairs while Officer Patel searches the first floor? Go right ahead. I'd feel better if you did. For the next 10 minutes, Officer Patel examined the locks on every door and window and surveyed the garage. I stood at the counter, reading text messages and trying to will away my headache and the tension stiffening my neck as a police helicopter circled above the house. Connell and Patel finished searching the house at 9:02. We'll file an incident report, even though there's no evidence of a break-in. Officer Connell handed me his business card. We're more than a little busy, but if you notice anything unusual, don't hesitate to call 911. It's possible my daughter left the back door open. She's glued to her damn phone, bumping into walls, distracted all the time. You know how they are. I got 3 of my own. Same thing, and no sign they're growing out of it. I noticed you don't have an alarm system, Officer Patel interjected. You can never be too careful. There are bad actors out there. Even neighborhoods like this aren't entirely safe. There are all types passing through in all sorts of ways into this development. The main gate's just a deterrent, as we like to tell people. I've been meaning to install better outdoor lights and an alarm. I appreciate the reminder. I glanced at the oven clock. There's one more thing. My wife's at her mother's right now, all the way in Benson, and I'm supposed to pick up my daughter up from her school play at 9:30. Until that night, I never would have called the cops only to lie to their faces, but I was desperate to get out of the house. I'd ask one of her friend's parents to drive her home, but they're not answering texts. They probably turned their phones off for the play, and I can't be sure they'll turn them back on. I'm wondering if there's any chance I can slip out to pick her up. I'm worried she'll be standing outside, waiting alone in a dark parking lot. We're only letting first responders through right now. Officer Patel paused. But maybe we can help you out. He tilted his head toward the radio strapped to his shoulder and used shorthand and code to request clearance for a vehicle. What do you drive? He asked, glancing back at me. A black Lexus. I turned from the red and blue lights playing across the living room windows and wondered how much time would pass before the neighbors started texting about the McLean house. Do you need my plate number? Our guys know you're coming, and we'll escort you to the gate. I'm really grateful for your help. I know you're swamped tonight, and I'm ready to go right now. I latched the sliding glass door. I'll lock the front door behind you. My advice is to take your daughter to Denny's to kill an hour, Officer Connell said. By the time she finishes her Sunday, we'll have this guy or we won't. As long as she has her phone, I said, she'll be happy anywhere. Tell me about it, he said wearily. These young kids are all the same. Sliding into the Lexus, I was struck by the unmistakable smell of a freshly Simonized car. I settled into soft leather and surveyed the bells and whistles crowding the dashboard as the garage door rose behind me, and then I eased onto the driveway. On the main road, snaking through the subdivision, I strained to control the soft steering, applied just the right pressure to the delicate brakes, and drove no more than 3 miles per hour above the speed limit. It's hard not to tense up in front of cops, and I could barely see the road for the rain streaming down the windshield faster than the wipers could clear it. My heart was pounding too, with the finality of what I had just done. Diane was probably on her way home with Chloe. My only hope was to avoid passing her on the road. My headache flared as I edged past the Shelton's house. I felt queasy at the sight of police cars and ambulances, the fire engine, and the mobile forensics lab parked on the Sheltons' property. I glimpsed the iron wrought gate and marble fountain, the ivy creeping up the side of the house, and the decorative balconies and tiny crenulated turrets accentuating the facade Gina and Doug Shelton had meticulously maintained to no good end. Someone lacking in imagination or life experience might have called the scene surreal. The Shelton house represented the height, or the nadir, of strained dedication to dull artifice, the unreality of the world I was leaving behind. As I approached the main entrance, I cracked my window, but the cop in the booth simply waved me around a set of sawhorses and flares and through the open gate. Just like that, it was over. I was free. At a deserted intersection north of Monte Vista, I turned onto a one-lane road leading into the foothills, lowered the window, and let the smell of creosote and sage smudge my sour mood. At a rise in the road, I skidded onto the gravel shoulder. I turned off Ted's phone, and with my hand drawn inside the sleeve of Ted's Oxford, wiped down its screen and threw it into the dense scrub below the embankment. Another half mile down the road, I drew six $50 bills from Ted's wallet, scrubbed my prints from a stretch of smooth leather, and tossed the wallet into a sprawling patch of prickly pear cacti, a minefield of thorns no one would cross anytime soon. An amateur might have taken Ted's credit cards, but I wasn't about to nickel and dime. I had dozens of Roman coins and Morgan silver dollars in the trunk, and no reason to swipe a stolen credit card beneath the gas station surveillance cameras. Most people would have worried about missing a print or overlooking a strand of hair caught in the wallet's inner fold. Those things would only matter if I got caught, and I had no intention of getting caught. If the police found any fingerprints or DNA samples on Ted's phone or wallet or at the Shelton house, it wouldn't be the first time they got a glimpse of me. All the techs at the backlogged crime lab in Phoenix would learn was that I was the same individual responsible for dozens of other unsolved crimes, a blue-eyed Caucasian male with dark hair. Officer Patel might add something to the description, but days after working overtime in the driving rain, he might also have difficulty recalling the bend of a finger broken long ago or the intersecting ridges of purple scar tissue left where a drunken father once scalded a child's soft hand with spilled bacon grease. Having tossed Ted's wallet, I reached my arm over the top of my head, pressed my fingers to my temple, and cracked the joints in my neck. I took a deep breath and continued toward a trailhead, where I would swap the Lexus for the white Camry I had left in a secluded gravel lot hours earlier. I had planned to enter and exit Monte Vista Estates through its golf course, never anticipating the evening's complications. The monsoon storms even the best weather forecasters have difficulty predicting. The improbable discovery of Gina Shelton smoking alone in her dark house, even though the Sheltons' indiscreet pool boy had told me the Sheltons would be vacationing in St. Bart's. Gina Shelton's piercing screams, the window she'd opened wide to air out the upstairs study where her husband kept his antique coin collection in a small briefcase. The blow Gina Shelton landed on my head with an ashtray spilling Benson and Hedges just before I crushed her windpipe to silence her, and my frantic scramble through the development in search of somewhere to hide once the Sheltons' alarmed neighbors started appearing on front lawns and calling the police. It rankles me to know the Sheltons' neighbors will think of me as Gina's murderer. Gina Shelton was a suicide. By the time I got to her, she had been suffocating herself, one pack of menthols at a time, for years. I couldn't complain. I'd fled the first murder scene before any of the Sheltons' neighbors got a good look at me. Against the odds, I stumbled upon an unlocked house owned by a man too drunk to defend his own life, and I talked my way out of Monte Vista Estates with a fortune in rare coins. I'd be in Phoenix, swapping the white Camry for a blue Nissan by the time Diane even registered that Ted wasn't at home. I'd be nearing LA by morning when she figured out that Ted hadn't slept in the guest room. She would notice the absence of her Gucci bag and Ted's toiletries and probably assume Ted had finally initiated the trial separation she had long expected and desired. It might be days before she discovered Ted's body. Based on the pristine condition of her appliances, the bi-weekly visits of the maids she hired to sterilize her sprawling house, and her affected smile in the family photo, Diane wasn't the type to take a dip in the hot tub to relax. She wouldn't dare track dirt from the patio or trail water across the kitchen tiles. She'd drop an ice cube into a glass of Pinot Grigio and slip into a warm bubble bath instead. The hot tub was essentially Ted's, I figured, and if it was chlorinated properly, it would be days before Diane detected an odd smell and sought out its source, found a bolt cutter, or more likely wasted money on a locksmith. By then, a merry maid would have emptied every garbage can and hamper in the house, run the dishwasher and washing machine, and wiped down every counter with disinfectants, according to Diane's exacting specifications. My only hope was that Chloe wouldn't be present when someone opened the hot tub, that she wouldn't see her half-poached father floating face down, mulling in his own juices. With my headache finally fading, I reenacted the scene on the patio. Whatever my old therapist used to say, my brain is consumed by abstraction and analysis as much as it's wired for reaction. As I neared the trailhead, I identified the real problem with Ted and Diane. I'd seen it on their faces in the family photo. They were wound as tight as watch springs, yet ready for nothing. I recalled the uncomprehending look on Ted's face as he struggled to sit up in his hot tub, slipping and spluttering as I rushed him with a loose paver pulled from his garden. He hadn't even heard me unlatch the gate. He had only seen me coming when he opened his eyes to locate the glass of wine on the edge of the tub. He actually asked, "What are you doing?" as if he required clarification from a man obviously poised to crush his skull. I could have asked Ted the same question. He should have known to go inside with so many police sirens wailing and two helicopters shining searchlights on his neighborhood. He shouldn't have been drinking so much in a hot tub in the first place. That's how people drown. They get too comfortable and doze off like frogs in slowly warming water. Ted had been that guy who didn't know what was happening as it was happening, whether he was drowning in his own drool or confronting his killer. He had lacked the life experience and instinct to recognize a real threat and defend his home. As I cracked his skull and pushed him beneath the water, he didn't even put up a fight. His hands were as soft as the seats of his Lexus. Honestly, I put him out of his misery. I put Diane out of hers too, when I held Ted beneath the water until he went limp and then dropped his wine bottle, his stem glass, and his overpriced paver into the tub to mark the timely end of an irredeemable drunk. The more I thought about Ted, the more I realized Chloe would be better off in the long run for losing her father. This was a guy who hadn't even bothered to sober up for his daughter's play. He'd read Diane's note and crawled straight into a hot tub to stare at the clouds in a self-satisfied stupor. If I'd murdered her father in a rash moment, I'd saved Chloe from years of disappointing dealings with a hopelessly ineffectual man, and from the stultifying comfort and emotional neglect that can irreparably harm a developing child. I'd saved her from a life of learned helplessness by instilling a healthy fear and a realistic grasp of life's inevitable hardships in her young mind. My own father, for all his faults, toughened me up. He taught me to fend for myself. Chloe would never see the world in the same way as she had as a princess pining away in pink taffeta, lost in fantasy, and searching in vain for an absent father. My hope was that she would someday embrace her unsparing vision as a gift and forgive me, her father's murderer, and that she would see, instead of unchecked bloodshed, a small act of mercy. We hope you enjoyed A Small Mercy. But wait just a second, because if this tale gave you the shivers, let me assure you that truth is stranger than fiction. Now, history is littered with true tales of killers impersonating their victims, and for each example, there's an accompanying unique and wild story as to why and how it all went down. Serial killers from H.H. Holmes in 1893 to John Robinson more than 100 years later carried on lengthy correspondence with the families of their victims in order to obscure the fact of their loved ones' deaths. Mistress of disguise, Elaine Parent, cozied up to lonely women, earning their trust over time as a roommate or lover, only to later kill, and in one case dismember them, steal their identities and money, and live for a time as that woman, until the money ran out and it was time to move on to the next unsuspecting target. When Elaine was finally cornered, police were only able to tie her definitively to one murder, but she'd racked up 20 identities by then, several of them associated with dead or missing women. But in perhaps the best such case proving that truth is stranger than fiction, the 1997 discovery of a man shot in the neck and half buried alive in Delaware would unravel the carefully woven schemes of a brutal con man. George Calomeras killed for the first time in 1979, and while little exists in the public records to explain what led to the shooting death of a man named Carol Arnold, we do know that Calomeras went practically straight from the scene of the murder to a Marines recruitment office, begging to be enlisted and shipped out immediately. The recruiter was only too happy to oblige, and police caught up with him in a mess hall minutes before he was set to board a plane bound for boot camp. By 1989, George Calomeras was a free man. By the summer of 1996, he was a killer once again. Calomeras befriended a man named Gary Wayne Thomas, an heir to a school bus empire in North Carolina. During a card game, Calomeras shot Thomas to death, and this time, rather than attempting to flee by enlisting, he simply contacted Thomas's bank to let them know he was moving to Maryland. With the bank records in hand, Calomeras set up further accounts and identifications as Gary Wayne Thomas. He spent the next year and a half living off Thomas's money, even buying cars and going on vacation with the dead man's name. Because con artists never seemed to be particularly good at smart spending, the money soon began to run out, and so George Calomeras, now with the help of his new wife, Noreen, began looking for a new target. The couple spotted their perfect mark in a wealthy, wheelchair-bound Delaware man, Thomas Wayne Jones. Calomeras first befriended Jones, then broke into the man's house, shot him in the neck, seized banking records and a significant collection of rare gold coins, and then dumped the man in a nearby field. George and Noreen thought they were in the clear and attempted to start taking control of the bank accounts, but Thomas Wayne Jones had actually survived the entire ordeal. The police found him naked and barely alive, but he managed to tell them who his attacker had been. Calomeras was charged with attempted murder, but while in custody awaiting trial, he sought to hire a hitman in order to finish the job that he'd started, believing that if Jones was unable to testify against him, the case would simply vanish. Foiled in every way, Calomeras was charged first with the attempted contract killing, and then ultimately with murder when Thomas Wayne Jones succumbed to his gunshot injuries. We can only wonder if the imposter in this story, A Small Mercy, Ted McLean, ever got to cash in on the gold coins he stole from the Sheltons before eluding the police. But we know for a fact that George Calomeras never did. He died in prison while serving out a 400-year sentence. Today's story comes to us from Alice Hatcher, and here's what she has to say. A Small Mercy was inspired by a stormy night I came home to find my power out, dogs barking all around my neighborhood, and two police helicopters hovering over my street. At one point, sitting alone in the dark, I heard a strange noise and began to worry that I had forgotten to lock a door before going out earlier in the evening. To create my narrator, I channeled my experience of feeling trapped in a dark house and uncertain about what was happening outside, or perhaps even inside my house, as squad cars slowly circled the block. Alice Hatcher is the author of The Wonder That Was Ours, which was longlisted for the Center of Fiction's 2008 First Novel Award. Hatcher's short fiction and essays have appeared in numerous journals, including Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, Alaska Quarterly Review, Pleiades, Bellevue Literary Review, and Fourth Genre. Hatcher teaches at the Tucson branch of the New York City-based creative writing school, The Writer Studio. Now, if you love this story, you will find hundreds of others in the print and digital editions of the Alfred Hitchcock's and Ellery Queen's mystery magazines. Visit alfredhitchcockmysterymagazine.com and ellerycreenmysterymagazine.com to order your subscription. And make sure to subscribe to this show. Give us a great rating and review on your favorite podcast app and share with others so that we can keep the show growing and going.